My guess is that you'll be as pleased that we're indoors as we are. I thought it was very cold this morning, and I'm actually quite cold now. Now, Michael Pennington, anybody who loves theatre and loves Shakespeare will know all about Michael. And so, but just to refresh your memories and mine, he founded the English Shakespeare Company in 1986 with Michael Bogdanov, and was its joint artistic director. And when I went back to check on the Shakespeare parts he's played, he has played them all, really, basically. It's really a matter of which ones you haven't played. He hasn't played Cordelia or Rosalind, but there's time yet. I mean, but he's played everything. He's played Henry V and Hal, Angelo in Measure for Measure, John of Gaunt wonderfully in Richard II at the Royal Shakespeare Company a couple of years ago, Hamlet, Edgar, Antony, Macbeth, Coriolanus. It is actually almost, you've almost got the set, haven't you, really?
Must be 750 parts in Shakespeare. A rough estimate.
But not many of them big. You've got the Leontes, I mean, that's a lot. And numerous nominations for Olivier Awards and things. What you may be slightly less familiar with, but very irrelevant in a literary festival, is his writing and his solo Chekhov shows. But his writing, he's written a wonderful book called, well, you probably can find them back there. I'm not sure what you've got back there, but Sweet William, subtitled 20,000 Hours of Shakespeare, which is sort of his career. And his Chekhov work is Are You There, Crocodile? And then he's just brought out a couple of years ago. Last year?
Earlier this year, actually.
Let Me Play the Lion, too, which is a wonderful title and is a delightful read and published by Fabers. And have you got that, Let Me Play the Lion, too? It's a cracker. You'll really enjoy that. I mean, so that's Michael. There's not much more to say, except, but he is going to read John Donne's poems, wonderful. And then if there's a bit of time at the end, we might have a chat, because there are one or two problems that I've got with Donne. I should add a curiosity. Both Michael and I were at Cambridge, at Trinity College, Cambridge, at roughly the same time. I'm glad to say he's slightly older than me. We did overlap by a year. And we were taught by a man called Theo Redpath, who was our tutor in Trinity, and I think you went to as few supervisions as I did, really. But he was very good, and he is a Donne scholar, and anybody who really loves Donne, he's written a rather good book on Donne's songs and sonnets, and I think he's now dead, Theo, isn't he?
I assume so, yeah.
If we are our age, we were 20 then,
yeah,
and he must
I think
be.
That's pretty clear.
But we didn't actually really know each other at Cambridge, did we?
No.
I think we had a lot of friends in common, but didn't know each other. I spent the rest of my life thinking that I played Mamilius in a production at Cambridge of The Winter Sayer when Michael was Leontes, and I've been talking about. I think I told Jill, my wife, that I'd done this, and it was only a few months ago that I reminded Michael of this, and he said, "No, you didn't." Total fiction. You didn't play Leontes.
Didn't play Leontes for another 30 years, I don't think.
So why I've convinced myself that we didn't, but I've dined out on it for a long
That's
time.
That's very flattering, Mark.
I'm now going to have to abandon that. So yeah. I was an appallingly bad Mamilist, whoever was the Leontes, but it wasn't Michael. Right, Michael, John Donne.
Thanks very much, Mark. That's a very generous, lovely introduction. I'm going to start by reading you two poems, the first of which is clearly about a lover trying to get to his girlfriend, despite her parents' nighttime watchfulness in their house. Once, and but once found in thy company, all thy supposed escapes are laid on me. And as a thief at bar is questioned there by all the men that have been robbed that year, So am I by this traitorous means surprised, by thy hydroptic father catechized. Though he had wont to search with glazed eyes, as though he came to kill a cockatrice, though he hath oft sworn that he would remove thy beauty's beauty and food of our love, hope of his goods, if I with thee were seen, yet close and secret as our souls we've been. Though thy immortal mother, which doth lie still buried in her bed, yet will not die, takes this advantage to sleep out daylight and watch thy entries and returns all night, and when she takes thy hand and would seem kind, doth search what rings and armlets she can find, and kissing notes the colour of thy face, and fearing lest thou art swollen, doth thee embrace, and politically will to thee confess the sins of her own youth's rank lustiness, yet love these sorceries did remove, and move thee to gull thine own mother for my love. Thy little brethren, which like fairy sprites oft skipped into our chamber those sweet nights, and kissed and ingled on thy father's knee, were bribed next day to tell what they did see. The grim 8-foot-high iron-bound serving man that oft names God in oaths, and only then, which if in hell no other pains there were, makes me fear hell because he must be there, though by thy father he were hired to this, could never witness any touch or kiss. I taught my silks their whistling to forbear, even my oppressed shoes dumb and speechless wear. But oh, too common ill, I brought with me that which betrayed me to my enemy, a loud perfume, which at my entrance cried, even at thy father's nose, so were we spied. When like a tyrant king that in his bed smelt gunpowder, the pale wretch shivered. Had it been some bad smell, he would have thought that his own feet or breath that smell had wrought. And now here's another poem, a seemingly penitent poem, which speaks for itself. Batter my heart, three-person God. For you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, o'erthrow me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town to another due, labour to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is captived and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie, or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. Now you might wonder how the same writer could deliver two such very different poems. How can they both be part of the same sensibility? Now, this is a question you ask quite often with Shakespeare. He could give you a comedy speech about a lover in that first situation, which would probably be a burlesque version of Romeo and Juliet seen on the balcony of her parents' house, and then chill the blood with some mortal sonnet about death approaching like the waves on the pebbled shore, and 100 things beside. Well, Shakespeare's not the only one. In fact, not even the only one in the late 16th and early 17th century. You know who I mean, or you wouldn't be here. John Donne slipped into so many roles in his life. Lawyer, court secretary, young soldier who, although afraid that he would come back as a sack of broken bones, even fought with Sir Walter Raleigh against the Spanish at Cadiz. The self-styled Jack Donne the lover, Dr. Donne of St. Paul's, that he almost seems like an actor in a series of different characters. Each role he takes is filled with his passion and intellect, his philosophical curiosity, his humour and candour and intensity. There are a number of good John Donne biographies around at the moment. John Carey's, for instance, which is a fine piece of literary criticism, though not particularly affectionate to the man himself, and a warmer biography by John Stubbs. And my hour with you this morning is not enough to compete with them in doing justice to the life, even had I the expertise. So I speak not quite as an expert, though not quite as an impostor either. The best I can do, in fact, is to celebrate, like Mark, my half century of admiration for his work. Even if in the early days some of my enthusiasm might have been less to do with the art of poetry than with the hope of being able to somehow emulate his lyrics to become a reasonably accomplished ladies' man myself. So I'll let him speak for himself shortly, but first we'll just do a few facts. Like Shakespeare, in fact, Donne was born of a recusant Catholic family, the third of six children. His father was a London ironmonger, where Shakespeare's was a Stratford glovemaker. His father died when he was four, while Shakespeare's was disgraced when Shakespeare was a young adolescent. And this comparison with Shakespeare persists, because they were both uninterested in publication for posterity. Only one portrait of each of them exists that's of any interest, in which they both have a slight look of the gypsy. There's no evidence that the two men ever met, though they were exact contemporaries. Donne would certainly have seen Shakespeare on the stage as an actor, however. He was one of a certain kind of Englishman that still exists, who enjoy the theatre but are wary of the people who do it. Well, more than wary in Donne's case, he despised playwrights, for instance, for giving idiot actors a living. And he especially despised, serves him right actually, despised his son-in-law Edward Alleyne, Shakespeare's great rival, though he admired his performance as Tamburlaine. Apart from both his parents' Catholicism, Donne's great-great-uncle was the martyred Sir Thomas More. When Donne was nine, his uncle was exiled for running an underground Jesuit mission, and his younger brother, Henry, died from plague in Newgate Prison, where he'd been incarcerated for harbouring a seminary priest. At 11, Donne went to Hertford College, Oxford, universities being open to much younger ages then, and then to Cambridge until he was 17, but he couldn't get a degree, since all students had to take the oath of supremacy at that moment, which as a Catholic he couldn't do. He then went to Lincoln's Inn to study for the law, not that he really intended to practice, but the Inns of Court at that time represented a kind of gentleman's club or male finishing school for many young men who had no professional ambitions. So swilling around in him from the start was an instinctive rebelliousness, a tormented adherence to Catholicism, and especially what he called an hydroptic, immoderate desire of humane learning and languages. He went on to write epigrams, elegies, epithalamians, which are poems to usher in a wedding night, obsequies, political satires, divine sonnets, and eventually at least 150 sermons, some of which took 2 hours to deliver. All that, and a great number of letters in verse to his friends, because he believed that letter writing might be even more important than lovemaking for the purposes of intimacy. He said, "When we think of a friend, we do not count that thought a lost thought, though this friend never knew of it. If we write to a friend, we must not call it a lost letter, though it never find him to whom it was addressed." However, it's for the love poems, of course, that most people knew him. And they come down the centuries to us not only because of their wit and beauty, but sometimes because of their extreme conversational directness, even if elsewhere his ideas can become so tortuous that we can only admire them without following them. And I would say that what Shakespeare did for English drama, Donne certainly did for English love poetry. And indeed, as a matter of interest, what both did for the written word, their contemporary Caravaggio was doing at exactly the same time for realistic figurative art in Italy. Think of the precise human detail in Caravaggio's pictures, their realism, their capture of a split second of action. And just those same qualities in Shakespeare's language or in Donne's jolts of colloquial speech amidst all his intellectual inquiry. "I wonder by my troth what thou and I did till we loved." And you're tempted to think that these three artists were creating modernity single-handedly. Both Shakespeare and Caravaggio, though his sexual orientation was different, would certainly have liked this poem of Donne's about another frustrated lover. They'd have put them either into a painting or into some wicked seducer's mouth. "Mark but this flea, and mark in this how little that which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first, and now sucks thee. And in this flea our two bloods mingle be. Thou knowest that this cannot be said a sin, nor shame, nor loss of maidenhead, yet this, in joys before it woo, and pampered swells with one blood made of two. And this, alas, is more than we would do. Oh, stay! Three lives in one flea spare, where we almost, nay, more than married are. This flea is you and I, and this our marriage bed and marriage temple is. Though parents grudge and you, we are met and cloistered in these living walls of jet. Though use make you apt to kill me, let not to that self-murder added be, and sacrilege, three sins in killing three. Ah, cruel and sudden, hast thou since purpled thy nail in blood of innocence? Wherein could this flea guilty be, except in that drop which is sucked from thee? Yet thou triumphst, and sayest that thou find'st not thyself nor me the weaker now. 'Tis true. Then learn how false fears be. Just so much honour when thou yield'st to me will waste, as this flea's death took life from thee. Well, I don't know if you can really call this love poetry exactly. Rather, it's a somewhat outlandish means of seduction. And as we love autobiography in our poets, we always like to imagine that this is Jack Donne himself, wooing, if that's quite the word, some girl long disappeared into history. On the other hand, it may just be a Jack Donne that Donne himself imagined, just as certain actors find a perfect role for themselves and play it for a lifetime. With him, you never quite know, but I am inclined myself to take Donne personally. So, let us suppose the flea was successful and that Donne had his way. Here, perhaps, he is the morning after on the subject of woman's constancy. Now thou hast loved me one whole day. Tomorrow, when you leavest, what wilt thou say? Wilt thou then antedate some new-made vow, or say that now we are not just those persons which we were, or that oaths made in reverential fear of love and his wrath any may forswear, or as true deaths, true marriages untie, so lovers' contracts, images of those, bind but till sleep, death's image them unloose, or your own end to justify, for having purposed change and falsehood, you can have no way but falsehood to be true. Vain lunatic, gainst these scapes I could dispute and conquer if I would, which I abstain to do, for by tomorrow I may think so too. I do sometimes think that Donne's girlfriends would have needed a university degree, had there been such a thing available to them, to follow his wooing. However lyrical he is, there is always intellectual energy, and elbowing in all the time is Donne the persuader, the philosopher, the geographer, the metaphysical, in fact, all his gifts cheerfully applied to the serious business of seducing women. In one, he famously accompanies a poem about his mistress undressing with a discourse about gems, Atlanta, Mahomet's paradise, and mystic books. So the poor girl had to put up not only with the flea, but with a lot of riddling philosophy, and also with a somewhat defensive declaration of non-commitment from her lover. She even leaves with the unusual instruction from him to be as unfaithful as he intends to be. This is called the indifferent. I can love both fair and brown, her whom abundance melts and her whom want betrays, her who loves loneliness best and her who masks and plays, her whom the country formed and whom the town, her who believes and her who tries, her who still weeps with spongy eyes and her who is dry cork and never cries. I can love her and you, I can love any, so she be not true. Now, we may not be finding Jack Donne very attractive so far, but soon we realise that all this worldly cynicism is really a form of posturing. There is an anxiety, an insecurity in Donne the lover. His problem seems sometimes not seducing the woman, but keeping her faithful, even if he's not. He can be sometimes stressful and easily hurt by female toughness. Perhaps in a way, he feared exclusion from a woman's love as much as he later feared exclusion from God's grace. Go and catch a falling star. get with child a mandrake root. Tell me what all past years are, or who cleft the devil's foot. Teach me to hear mermaids singing, or to keep off envy stinging, and find what wind serves to advance an honest mind. If thou be'st born to strange sights, things invisible to see, ride 10,000 days and nights till age snow white hairs on thee. Thou, when thou return'st, wilt tell me all strange wonders that befell thee, and swear nowhere lives a woman true and fair. If thou find'st one, let me know. Such a pilgrimage was sweet. Yet do not. I would not go, though at next door we might meet. Though she were true when you met her, and last till you write your letter, yet she will be false ere I come to two or three. Now this division between arrogance and uncertainty is even more vividly expressed in a poem called The Apparition, which comes across as quite a Shakespearean jealous fantasy. When by thy scorn, O murderess, I am dead, and that thou think'st thee free from all solicitation from me, then shall my ghost come to thy bed, and thee, feigned vestal, in worse arms shall see. Then thy sick taper will begin to wink, and he whose thou art then, being tired before, will, if thou stir or pinch to wake him, think thou call'st for more, and in false sleep will from thee shrink. And then, poor aspen wretch, neglected, thou bathed in a cold quicksilver sweat wilt lie, a verier ghost than I. What I will say, I will not tell thee now, lest that preserve thee. And since my love is spent, I'd rather thou shouldst painfully repent than by my threatenings rest still innocent. Now this is much more endearing, I think. It's a young man's personality in need of reconciling. And sure enough, a form of salvation is at hand in the form of a woman who is both a friend and a match for him. And a genuine warmth, not to say cheerful hyperbole, enters the writing, suggesting a certain relaxed quality as of love realized. Busy old fool, unruly son, why dost thou thus through windows and through curtains call on us? Must to thy motions lovers' seasons run? Saucy, pedantic wretch, go chide late schoolboys and sour apprentices. Go tell court huntsmen that the king will ride. Call country ants to harvest offices. Love all alike no season knows nor clime, nor hours, days, months, which are the rags of time. Thy beams, so reverend and strong, why shouldst thou think? I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink, but that I would not lose her sight so long. If her eyes have not blinded thine, look, and tomorrow late tell me whether both the Indias of spice and mine be where thou left'st them, or lie here with me. Ask for those kings whom thou sawest yesterday, and thou shalt hear all here in one bed lay. She is all states, and all princes I, nothing else is. Princes do but play us. Compared to this, all honours mimic, all wealth alchemy. Thou, son, art half as happy as we, in that the world's contracted thus. Thine age asks ease, and since thy duties lie to warm the world, that's done in warming us. Shine here to us, and thou art everywhere. This bed thy centre is, these walls thy sphere. And the ease and simplicity of this, too, sounds like accomplished love, is called the good morrow. I wonder by my troth what thou and I did till we loved. Were we not weaned till then, but sucked on country pleasures childishly? Or snorted we in the seven sleepers' den? 'Twas so, but this all pleasures fancies be. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, 'twas but a dream of thee. And now good morrow to our waking souls, which watch not one another out of fear, for love all love of other sights controls, and makes one little room and everywhere. Let sea discoverers to new worlds have gone. Let maps to other worlds on worlds have shown. Let us possess one world. Each hath one and is one. My face in thine eye, thine in mine appears, and true plain hearts do in the faces rest. Where can we find two better hemispheres, without sharp north, without declining west? Whatever dies was not mixed equally. If our two loves be one, or thou and I love so alike that none do slacken, none can die. And I think in our dramatization of his life, this must be Anne Moore, the daughter of the politician Sir George Moore. Her mother had died young. Still, left alone with her father, she'd become unusually well-read and well-educated for a woman in those times, which makes up a little for the galling fact that we have no idea what she looked like, and neither portraits nor any letters in her hand. So she is strangely lost to us, aptly enough, since Donne always did all the talking. But clever and beautiful, she sounds perfect for him. But she was also very young. By the time that he and Anne Moore married, they'd known each other long enough to celebrate a lover's anniversary. All kings and all their favourites, all glory of honours, beauties, wits, the sun itself which makes times as they pass, is elder by a year now than it was when thou and I first one another saw. All other things to their destruction draw, only our love hath no decay. This no tomorrow hath, nor yesterday. Running it never runs from us away, but truly keeps his first, last, everlasting day. Two graves must hide thine and my course. If one might, death were no divorce. Alas, as well as other princes, we, who prince enough in one another be, must leave at last in death these eyes and ears, oft fed with true oaths and with sweet salt tears. But souls where nothing dwells but love, all other thoughts being inmates, then shall prove this or a love increased there above, when bodies to their graves, souls from their graves remove. And then we shall be thoroughly blessed, but we no more than all the rest. Here upon earth we are kings, and none but we can be such kings, nor of such subjects be. Who is so safe as we? Where none can do treason to us, except one of us too. True and false fears, let us refrain. Let us love nobly, and live, and add again years and years unto years, till we attain to write 80. This is the second of our reign. In real life, Donne and Anne married in 1601, when she was only 16 and he was 29. Isaac Walton, Donne's friend and biographer, once declared that their natures were generous and accustomed to confer, but he added that marrying Anne was the remarkable error of his life. This was true in a strategic sense. It certainly ruined his already somewhat stuttering career. He was not, after all, what we would call a professional poet. There was no such thing, and he still needed to find a place for himself in the world. The problem really was the manner of his marrying, which was in secret and without her father's consent, and she was, of course, very young. The outraged Sir George Moore set about wrecking Donne's life, causing the loss of his job. He'd managed to become political secretary to the Lord Keeper of the Great Seal, Sir Thomas Egerton, and was even living at Egerton's grand London home close to the Palace of Whitehall. Moore challenged the Union's legality and had him thrown into the obnoxious Fleet Prison for a time. Donne talked his way out of all this in the end. He always wrote a good pleading letter. The marriage was upheld, and indeed Sir George calmed down and even helped the couple financially. But it was the beginning of a life of frustrated artistic brilliance, but absolutely no public recognition or regular employment until Donne took holy orders in 1614, 12 years later. So what was Donne's life like for this first decade of James I's reign? Well, he wrote a lot of letters, mostly begging for work or poetic commissions. Anne was continually pregnant or nursing. In their 16 years of marriage, she bore him 12 children, including 2 stillbirths and 3 survivors who then died in the same year before they were 10. We still get very little impression of her, though we get plenty of him. His grief at the children's deaths caused him to contemplate suicide. By children's births and deaths, I am become so dry that I am now my own sad tomb. But he also acknowledged that they reminded him that he now had fewer mouths to feed. I suspect that rather than callousness, this must have induced a permanent state of guilt over the woman he admitted he had transplanted into a wretched fortune. I do believe they were close, intellectually and emotionally, codependent, we would say, though Dunn is obviously the more talkative, while she remains stubbornly off the record. Dunn certainly found making his way in the new and labyrinthine world of Jacobean politics and diplomacy a continual struggle. He wanted a proper job for reasons of self-worth and a desperate need for acceptance as well as of practicality. Without it, he felt you were no link in God's chain, but a fingernail, a hair, a mole on the face. But the scandal over his marriage pursued him all his life, even into the pulpit of St. Paul's Cathedral at the end of it. Combined, no doubt, with his highly idiosyncratic personality that was almost too smart for comfort, certainly the comfort of those who dispense favours, his sheer originality as a man and as a writer conspired to make the central period of his life in the Jacobean era of patronage and mutual obligation, very well described by Shakespeare in Timon of Athens, extremely difficult. An urban Londoner, if ever there was one, he and his huge family had to live in the suburbs of Mitcham and Purford, largely paid for by his wife's cousin. Dunn scraped a meagre living as a lawyer and a sort of literary odd job man, occasional pamphlets and articles. He was briefly elected MP for Brackley, but this was not a paid position, and the rest of his time was spent begging for favours and commissions, offering poems of praise for his clients' relatives whom he would hardly have known, celebrations of unknown weddings, very much as Shakespeare did when plague closed the theatres and he had to earn a crust from the Earl of Southampton and the rest. Dunn had always refused to publish his poems, which have only survived by being circulated hand to hand among a small coterie of admirers, and to that extent he was a fool to himself, ignored by the establishment despite the high esteem he held among the literati. What commissions there were came from wealthy friends or patrons, including a variety of countesses, and they have a slightly erotic air of intense and overwrought dependency. He certainly opened his heart to them, especially to Lucy, Countess of Bedford, for whom he wrote the famous Nocturnal upon St. Lucy's Day on the occasion of the death in the same year of the Countess's daughter and one of his own, Lucy Dunn. It does express a feeling of utter negation and hopelessness. 'Tis the year's midnight, and it is the day's. Lucy's, who scarce 7 hours herself unmasks. The sun is spent, and now his flasks send forth light squibs, no constant rays. The world's whole sap is sunk. The general balm the hydroptic earth hath drunk. Whither as to the bed's feet life is shrunk, dead and interred. Yet all these seem to laugh compared with me, who am their epitaph. Study me, then, you who shall lovers be at the next world, that is, at the next spring, for I am every dead thing, in whom love wrought new alchemy. For his art did express a quintessence even from nothingness, from dull privations and lean emptiness. He ruined me, and I am rebegot of absence, darkness, death, things which are not. But I am by her death, which word wrongs her, of the first nothing the elixir grown. Were I a man, that I were one, I needs must know. I should prefer, if I were any beast, some ends, some means, yea plants, yea stones detest and love, all some properties invest. If I an ordinary nothing were, a shadow, a light and body must be here. But I am none, nor will my sun renew. You lovers, for whose sake the lesser sun at this time to the goat is run, to fetch new lust and give it you, enjoy your summer all. Since she enjoys her long night's festival, let me prepare towards her, and let me call this hour her vigil and her eve, since this both the year's and the day's deep midnight is. However, his heart is still very much with Anne. Listen to the warmth of this. Dear love, for nothing less than thee would I have broke this happy dream. It was a theme for reason, much too strong for fantasy. Therefore thou wak'st me wisely, yet my dream thou brok'st not, but continued'st it. Thou art so true that thoughts of thee suffice to make dreams truths and fables histories. Enter these arms, for since thou thought'st it best not to dream all my dream, let's act the rest. As lightning or a taper's light, thine eyes and not thy noise waked me. Yet I thought thee, for thou lovest truth, an angel at first sight. But when I saw thou sawest my heart, and knewest my thoughts beyond an angel's art, when thou knewest what I dreamt, when thou knewest when excess of joy would wake me, and camest then, I must confess it could not choose but be profane to think thee anything but thee. Coming and staying showed thee, thee, but rising makes me doubt that now thou art not thou. That love is weak where fear's as strong as he. 'Tis not all spirit, pure and brave, if mixture it of fear, shame, honour have. Perchance as torches, which must ready be, men light and put out, so thou dealst with me. Thou cam'st to kindle, goest to come, then I will dream that hope again, but else would die. Dunn continued to be away from home a great deal. Once, and this is something we know did happen, he embarked on a European tour to France and Italy, which was already a standard rite of passage for young men seeking to fill out a liberal education, rather as they did in the 19th century. Anne wants to come with him, and Dunn imagines her following him dressed as some Shakespearean page. It's a poem of abundant good humour, as he imagines her picturing his death, rather as if she was Shakespeare's Juliet with her nurse, and fantasising xenophobically about the nefarious overtures of the French and the Italians they're going to meet. By our first strange and fatal interview, by all desires which thereof did ensue, by our long starving hopes, by that remorse which my word's masculine persuasive force begot in thee, and by the memory of hurts which spies and rivals threaten me, I calmly beg. But by thy father's wrath, by all pains which want and divorcement hath, I conjure thee, and all the oaths which thou and I have sworn to seal joint constancy, here I unswear and overswear them thus, thou shalt not love by ways so dangerous. Temper, O fair love, love's impetuous rage, be my true mistress still, not my feigned page. I'll go, and by thy kind leave behind thee, only worthy to nurse in my mind thirst to come back. Oh, if thou die before, my soul from other lands to thee shall soar. Thy else almighty beauty cannot move rage from the seas, nor thy love teach them love, nor tame wild Boreas harshness. Thou hast read how roughly he in pieces shivered fair Orithia, whom he swore he loved. Fall ill or good, 'tis madness to have proved dangers unurged. Feed on this flattery that absent lovers one in the other be. Dissemble nothing, not a boy, nor change thy body's habit, nor mind. Be not strange to thyself only. All will spy in thy face a blushing, womanly, discovering grace. Richly clothed apes are called apes, and as soon eclipsed as bright, we call the moon the moon. Men of France, changeable chameleons, spittles of diseases, shops of fashions, love's fuelers, and the writer's company of players, which upon the world's stage be, will quickly know thee, and no less, alas, the indifferent Italian, as we pass his warm land, well content to think thee page, will hunt thee with such lust and hideous rage as Lot's fair guests were vexed. But none of these, nor spongy, hydroptic Dutch, shall thee displease if thou stay here. Oh, stay here, for thee England is only a worthy gallery, to walk in expectation, till from thence our greatest king call thee to his presence. When I am gone,
dream me some happiness. Nor let thy looks our long-hid love confess. Nor praise, nor dispraise me, nor bless, nor curse openly love's force, nor in bed fright thy nurse with midnight startings, crying out, "Oh, oh, nurse, oh, my love is slain. I saw him go o'er the white Alps alone. I saw him, I, assailed, fight, taken, stabbed, bleed, fall, and die. Or give me better chance, except, dread Jove, think it enough for me to have had thy love." What he doesn't say is that Anne was about to give birth to the third of their 12 children, and she couldn't come anyway. This tendency of his to be away at important family times does become a habit, and you could criticise him for it, but I insist on continuing to think of him as a devoted and dependent lover in his eccentric way. But you do get an unusual feeling that as much as he loved her, he once said that we had not one another at so cheap a rate that we should ever be weary of each other, he chafed all his life at domestic life and at living on another man's charity for most of it. At one point, ever self-dramatizing, he said that he had died 10 years ago. There is a sense that in the most affectionate and unneurotic way, the couple were tired of each other. How can you entirely love a man who comes home just for long enough to make you pregnant 12 times and then goes away again? How can you love a woman in whose eyes you constantly see disappointment with the life you brought her into? John Donne's famous conversion from poet to Dean of St. Paul's has been discussed a great deal, usually in terms of surprise that the erotic poet could become a holy man. It's a surprise that should evaporate the moment you encounter the passion and turbulence in his later writing. The love poet and hellfire preacher are undoubtedly one and the same. And the conversion was pretty clear the result, clearly the result of many things. Some sense of repentance, which you can read from his sudden damning of sexuality outside marriage and a general shift to the moral right wing. A practical reaction to his failure to earn a living, largely because of his refusal to exploit what he was best at by publishing his best poems. But it was also the natural development of someone who'd always indeed been a metaphysical, a lapsed Catholic who, though he mocked Catholics in his pseudo-martyr for believing that St. Anthony preached to fish who put their heads above the water to listen and nod in agreement, still found turning Anglican a spiritual struggle. He was for sure a man who was all his life on a search. On a huge hill, cragged and steep, truth stands, and he that will reach her about must and about must go, and what the hill's suddenness resists, win so. In 1615, he took holy orders, King James having convinced him of his fitness for a ministry to which he was very unwilling, apprehending it to be too weighty for his abilities. But James made him Doctor of Divinity in Cambridge to the university's fury, as he was seen there as a son of night and darkness. He allowed some of his more notorious love poems to be published just before he entered the ministry as a hedge against possible failure in the church. Must have been a little bit as if the incumbent Archbishop of Canterbury should publish a book of erotic poetry first. But then Anne died in a stillborn childbirth. As Donne said, as a by now ordained priest to the benches at Lincoln's Inn a year later, his theme being obedience to God's will, "God hath beaten down thy green fruit from the beloved tree. God hath hewn down the beloved tree itself, the young children and the mother of those children he hath taken from thee." For thee, of course, we need to read me. Here is how he mourned Anne in poetry in his 17th holy sonnet. "Since she whom I loved hath paid her last debt to nature and to hers, and my good is dead, and her soul early into heaven ravished, wholly on heavenly things my mind is set. Here the admiring her my mind did wet to seek thee, God, so streams do show the head. But though I have found thee, and thou my thirst hast fed, a holy thirsty dropsy melts me yet. But why should I beg more love, when as thou dost woo my soul for hers offering all thine, and dost not only fear lest I allow my love to saints and angels things divine, but in thy tender jealousy dost doubt lest the world, flesh, yea, devil, put thee out. So it was a little as if he was switching his commitment from her to God. The heavenly things on which he declares his mind will now be set led to an extraordinary body of work in verse and prose. The emergence, for example, of a sequence of holy sonnets informed by a naked fear of mortality. Thou hast made me, and shall thy work decay? Repair me now, for now mine end doth haste. I run to death, and death meets me as fast, and all my pleasures are like yesterday. I dare not move my dim eyes anyway. Despair behind and death before doth cast such terror, and my feeble flesh doth waste by sin in it, which it towards hell doth weigh. Only thou art above, and when towards thee by thy leave I can look, I rise again. But our old subtle foe so tempteth me that not one hour I can myself sustain. Thy grace may wing me to prevent his art, and thou, like adamant, draw mine iron heart. Even more interesting, perhaps, the prose, such as this from Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions, which was a series of 23 meditations written during one of Donne's increasingly frequent illnesses, one for each day of its course. I am come by thy goodness to the use of thine ordinary means for my body to wash away those peccant humours that endangered it. I have, O Lord, a river in my body, but a sea in my soul, and a sea swollen into the depth of a deluge above the sea. Thou hast raised up certain hills in me heretofore, by which I might have stood safe from these inundations of sin. And to the top of all these hills thou hast brought me heretofore. But this deluge, this inundation, is got above all my hills, and I have sinned and sinned and multiplied sin to sin. After all these thy assistance is against sin, and where is the water enough to wash away this deluge? Or, most famously, this. Perchance he for whom this bell tolls may be so ill as that he knows not it tolls for him. And perchance I may think myself so much better than I am, as that they who are about me and see my state may have caused it to toll for me, and I know not that. The church is Catholic, universal, so are all her actions. All that she does belongs to all. When she baptizes a child, that action concerns me. Who bends not his ear to any bell which upon any occasion rings? But who can remove it from that bell which is passing a piece of himself out of this world? No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Then one day in 1621, James I invited Donne to dinner, except that he didn't invite him to sit down, preferring to indulge in a kind of Donne-like metaphor. He said this, and before he had eaten any meat, he said after his pleasant manner, Dr. Donne, I've invited you to dinner, and though you sit not down with me, yet I will carve to you of a dish I know you love well. For knowing you love London, I do therefore make you Dean of St. Paul's. And when I have dined, then do you take your beloved dish home to your study. Say grace there to yourself, how much good may it do you. Well, now imagine St. Paul's Cathedral in 1621. Not the great dome of Christopher Wren, but its predecessor, what Wren himself called a great pile, and soon to be consumed in the great fire. Its ancient steeple, already reduced by fire to a mere stump, a sprawling medieval cathedral put together erratically over many years and somehow unfinished. Inside, it was more like a souk than a place of worship. Glaziers and carpenter shops and booksellers, packed with tourists on Sundays, rubbish piling up, drunks puking, kids having skating machines on puddles of their own urine, graffiti, bits of stone sometimes falling off it to the peril of bystanders, thieves gossiping, assignations being made, its characteristic sound, as one reporter said, like that of bees or of a still roar or loud whisper. The perfect tenure, you might say, for its new dean, a saintly man who was also a courtier and a man about town, a place of prayer but also of gossip and intrigue, flesh and spirit together. And here is the new dean climbing into his pulpit early on Christmas morning, 1621, to give his first sermon. He was about to face an audience rather than a congregation. They were accustomed to coming and going during the sermon, failing to kneel at the right time, and generally regarding the place as a chance for conversation as much as for worship. Like any performer, this annoyed the hell out of Dunn, but he was a match for it. It was only just daylight, and his theme was light, outer and inner, the light of things, of the sun and moon, of the stars, God's light, the light of science and of progress. Divers men may walk by the seaside, and the same beams of the sun giving light to them all. One gathereth by the benefit of that light pebbles or speckled shells for curious vanity, and another gathers precious pearl or medicinal amber by the same light. So the common light of reason illumines us all. But one employs this light upon the searching of impertinent vanities. Another, by a better use of the same light, finds out the mysteries of religion. And when he hath found them, loves them, not for the light's sake, but for the natural and true worth of the thing itself. If, after all this, thou canst turn this little light inward, and can thereby discern where thy diseases and thy wounds and thy corruptions are, thou shalt never envy the lustre and glory of the great lights of worldly men, which are great by the infirmity of others or by their own opinion. Others, by the benefit of this light, have searched and found the secret corners of gain and profit wheresoever they lie. They have found where was the easiest and most accessible way to solicit the chastity of a woman, whether discourse, music, or presence, and according to that discovery, they have pursued hers and their own eternal destruction. Well, a star was born, as was some of the most magnificent prose ever spoken in English. Isaac Walton describes what it was like for the next 10 years of Sundays as Dr. Dunn preached like a living prophet twice a day at enormous length to an audience who knew his past and perhaps had only imagined him to be an erotic poet and a satirist who had made a scandalous marriage. Walton says this: "He preached the word so as showed his own heart was possessed with those very thoughts and joys that he laboured to distil into others. A preacher in earnest, weeping sometimes for his auditory, sometimes with them, always preaching to himself like an angel from a cloud, but in none, carrying some, as St. Paul was, to heaven in holy raptures, and enticing others by a sacred art and courtship to amend their lives. Here picturing a vice so as to make it ugly to those that practiced it, and a virtue so as to make it be beloved even by those that loved it not. And all this with a most particular grace and an unexpressible addition of comeliness." Reminds me of Charles Dickens, whose readings from the novels caused his audiences to faint with terror. In fact, though, Dunn was by now imagining more and more what kind of man I should be at my end, upon my deathbed, what trembling hands and what lost legs, what deaf ears and what gummy eyes I shall have then. He was beginning to put his affairs in order meticulously, even providing for his mother who survived him. But even in his hymn to God the Father in my illness, the old punster is at work as he manages to get both his own and his wife's surnames to make his case for him. "Wilt thou forgive that sin where I begun, which was my sin though it were done before? Wilt thou forgive that sin through which I run, and do run still, though still I do deplore? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. Wilt thou forgive that sin which I have won others to sin, and made my sins their door? Wilt thou forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. I have a sin of fear, that when I've spun my last thread, I shall perish on the shore. But swear by thyself that at my death thy sun shall shine as he shines now and heretofore. and having done that thou hast done, I fear no more. He made his arrangements with a certain practical imagination. He wanted to be buried in the great thoroughfare that was St. Paul's, as if to prove indeed that no man was an island, or that in the great anthill of the world I am an ant, in the great field of clay I am a clod. Though he would indeed have preferred to die in full flood in the pulpit, he instead commissioned an artist to draw a staged version of his death, calling up the props and even building a wooden platform on which he could face east. Several charcoal fires being made in his large study, he brought with him into that place his winding sheet in his hand, and having put off all his clothes, had this sheet put on him, and so tied with knots at his head and feet, and his hands so placed as dead bodies are usually fitted and shrouded to be put into their coffin or grave. The subsequent monument in stone has miraculously survived the wear and tear of the centuries. Donne's hands are clasped inside his shroud, his shoulders are hunched and his knees bent. He's looking downwards with his eyes closed. A friend commented that it seemed to breathe faintly, a kind of artificial miracle. And when the actual moment came, after apparently talking until the last few seconds of his life, Donne went quiet, arranged his hands and body into such a posture as required the least alteration by those who came to shroud him. It is very much as if he was determined to meet death on its own terms, unsurprised and undefeated. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow. And soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and soul's delivery. Thou'rt slave to fate, chance, kings and desperate men, and dost with poison, war and sickness dwell. And poppy or charms can make us sleep as well and better than thy stroke. Why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death thou shalt die. At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise, arise from death, you numberless infinities of souls, and to your scattered bodies go. All whom the flood did and fire shall o'erthrow, all whom war, dearth, age, agues, tyrannies, despair, law, chance hath slain, and you whose eyes shall behold God and never taste death's woe. But let them sleep, Lord, and me mourn a space. For if above all these my sins abound, 'tis late to ask abundance of thy grace when we are there. Here on this lowly ground, teach me how to repent, for that's as good as if thou hadst sealed my pardon with thy blood. Or perhaps you prefer as a finishing note this perfect prayer of his that I'd certainly like at my funeral. Bring us, O Lord God, at our last awakening into the house and gate of heaven, to enter into that gate and dwell in that house where there should be no darkness, nor dazzling, but one equal light, no noise nor silence, but one equal music, no fears nor hopes, but one equal possession, no ends nor beginnings, but one equal eternity, in the habitations of thy glory and dominion, world without end. Or do you perhaps prefer this farewell from Jack Donne, the great visitor of ladies, whom I've heard described as the most tender, most scathing, and most paranoid love poet in English? Sweetest love, I do not go for weariness of thee, nor in hope the world can show a fitter love for me. But since that I must die at last, 'tis best to use myself in jest, thus by feigned deaths to die. Yesternight the sun went hence, and yet is here today. He hath no desire, nor sense, nor half so short a way. Then fear not me, but believe that I shall make speedier journeys, since I take more wings and spurs than he. Oh, how feeble is man's power, that if good fortune fall, cannot add another hour, nor a lost hour recall. But come bad chance, and we join to it our strength, and we teach it art and length, itself for us to advance. When thou sighest not wind, but sighest my soul away. When thou weep'st unkindly kind, my life's blood doth decay. It cannot be that thou lov'st me as thou sayest, if in thine my life thou waste, that art the best of me. Let not thy divining heart forthink me any ill. Destiny may take thy part, and may thy fears fulfill. But think that we are but turned aside to sleep. They who one another keep alive ne'er parted be. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael. But after 50 years of reading and loving Donne and hearing you today, I'm still baffled by how Jack Donne, the passionate lover, and became Dr. Donne, the passionate lover of God and the great divine. Can you say something a bit more about that?
I don't know that I know either. I mean, you can see that it was a medley of reasons. I mean, there was a repentance. There was some kind of penitence. He lived quite a wild life. And I think there was a genuine sense of penitence, as far as one can see, because he swung to the right so much morally. I mean, he really preached against sexuality before marriage. He was... He detested poor people and said as much. He thought of them as the great unwashed. There's a sort of swing in him, particularly against sexuality, which is obviously rather an extreme reaction and suggests a revulsion against it. There was the practical matter of earning a living, because, of course, he could make a living as a minister and especially as the dean, and he was so unused to being able to make a living, though why he didn't publish those poems in the first place, I don't know. I've got no special insight into it, but you can, as you can tell by reading them, and you felt it myself when I was reading, you sense the same sensibility, don't you? You know, he addresses God, he invites God to ravish him and all that. That's an obvious thing that any literary critic can pick up on. But there's an erotic energy, a sexual energy, somehow in that preaching, and apparently in his figure in the pulpit, which is tremendously charismatic. I would think very much like Dickens, this worn old man. So I don't quite know why, but the things can coexist, you know, the religious sensibility and the erotic sensibility, as we all know. Maybe someone else has got a theory.
I mean, he obviously had huge charisma and personality, and all these letters, and he had no trouble getting commissions, but did he have friendships, do you think? I mean,
I'm not sure that he had that much success with commissions. You know, those commissions are largely... odd jobs. You know, I don't know that he knew many of the people that he wrote the commissions for, these countesses he made a speciality of, because he was a great wooer. He could talk his way into their favours sufficiently to be given a commission to write, often on very mournful occasions for the ladies. I don't get a feeling... Well, he had friends. It's quite difficult to identify what they were, but his great friend Goodyear, three or four friends, and Isaac Walton, for instance, who clearly were close to him, but they weren't literary people especially, I don't think.
No. And how about Robert Drury, of whom...
He was a patron as well, wasn't he?
But I think he was a friend, do you not feel? Yeah. I mean, I'm sad that you didn't read the two poems to Drury's daughter, Elizabeth, who died, and beautiful anniversary poems.
Well, I'll come back next year.
Thank you very much.
So you could actually go on and on, can't
you? Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I felt that Drury... who gave the name to Drury Lane.
Yes, of course.
I felt that he liked Donne very much, or rather his wife did particularly, I think. perhaps that's the old story. Perhaps that's the answer.
He's not... I don't strike him as very collegiate. I don't get the feeling that he was part of a community of poets. I think he was so much his own man. He's quite an egotist. I mean, goodness me. It is funny how, you know, every time they lose a child, it's all about his suffering. You don't hear much about Anne, or indeed her life. So he had, you know, a sort of ego. He was...
It's interesting to read about his relationship with Alain, the actor. It amuses me particularly, of course, who was his son-in-law. He detested the theatre. I think he was quite difficult, really, and scornful and haughtily uninterested in circulating those poems. He just didn't seem to care.
I told him that he hated the theatre because...
Well, he went to it.
But his verse is so dramatic.
Incredibly.
Enormous, declamatory stuff. And also God's very sake, simple. Hold your tongue and let me laugh.
Yeah, absolutely that. And both declamatory and, like Shakespeare, with a wonderful simplicity sometimes. You know, veered between simplicity and high utterance in exactly the same way. But I'm not sure he would have liked that pointed out to him, maybe.
Anyway, I'm sure that you've turned us back to rereading Donne, and we will hear your voice when we do so. And meanwhile, you can keep Michael's voice in your mind with the back there, his books, and the most recent, Let Me Play the Lion, is from Midsummer Night's Dream, is a delight. So I can recommend that to you. I recommend them all to you. But thank you very much for coming. You've been a lovely audience. And
thank you, yes.
Thank you, Michael, very
lovely
much indeed.
Too. Thank you.